The next case for argument is 16-1128, Intellectual Ventures versus Erie Indemnity Company. Is everyone settled? In place? Okay, Mr. Hurt, whenever you're ready.
Welcome back to Los Angeles.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Christian Hurt, and I'm here this morning with my colleague Derek Gilliland on behalf of Intellectual Ventures in this case against Erie and Old Republic. I'd like to start with the 002 patent, since there was some discussion with the panel about that patent in the Capital One case.
Actually, can we start, though, because each case is taken separately. So I'm on this case and the standing issue on the 581. So
yes, Your Honor.
Talk to me about that issue.
For that issue, all of the evidence in the record points to Intellectual Ventures owning the 581 patent. All of the contemporaneous evidence points that way. Right after the All Advantage All Set transaction, All Set filed that assignment as part of the assignment record in the patent office. The patent issued in All Set's name.
Yeah, but I find it a little odd that when we're talking about an assignment and we've got a document, I don't want to start with all of the extrinsic evidence with regard to that document. Why don't we start with the document? I mean,
yes, Your Honor. The reason I start with the extrinsic evidence is under California law, the court accepts that extrinsic evidence provisionally to determine if a position on the actual contract.
You need to convince us that the assignment to Allset in January 2002 included a patent application that was not identified in that assignment.
It is not included in the
list.
It
is not identified. You're right. It's nowhere in here identified. So why would the parties not identify it and still believe that it was assigned?
Well, I think at most the non-identification shows that the language is ambiguous, and the reason for that is that the 581 patent is a child application of the 983, and it's not just a continuation. These patents are effectively the same patent as a result of a terminal disclaimer that was filed right after the Allset transaction. So the patent office rejected the 581.
Has there ever been a case that said a continuation patent is essentially the same patent as the parent patent?
There are a number of cases, including the General Protect case and others cited in our briefs, that the continuation.
That's implied license,
that's,
right?
That's correct.
That's not an assignment case.
That is correct. There is not an assignment case I could find that held that a continuation patent and the parent patent are the same. Now, the MPEP
Implied licenses, that's an equitable doctrine, right?
Well, I think the issue on implied license is the reason the court grants an implied license, whether equitable or factual, is because the licensed parent and the continuation are bound to the same inventive subject matter, such that it doesn't make sense for parties to split title in a license transaction and give someone the rights to the parent.
But you're not...
Yes, Your Honor.
You misspeak yourself when you say equitable or factual. It's equitable or legal.
Oh, my apologies. That's correct. Whether it's an equitable defense that gets tried to the court or ultimately a factual defense that would have a jury right, the underlying rationale is that the subject matter of the parent and the continuation are to the same inventive subject matter.
But the underlying law is totally different. One is contract law, the other is the law of equity.
Well, the law of equity provides the defense. In our case, we're talking about the transfer of a license is the underlying issue in implied license.
Determining the meaning of a contractual transfer under California law is a question of law, not of equity.
That is correct. And so,
I remember that from 1973.
The purpose of this transaction was to transfer all of the assets that All Advantage had essentially purchased from a predecessor company a few transactions down called Aveo. So a gentleman by the name of Paul Hurley, he had a patent portfolio. He then sold it to a company called Sherwood, and then All Advantage bought that portfolio from Sherwood, and then Paul Hurley came around and tried to buy his patents back. That was the point of the deal, and it all happened within 1 year. There's no extrinsic evidence that it was the intent of the parties to make this patent an orphan. So no one has ever asserted, despite Allset being the assignee on the face.
What about the fact that the prior assignment to All Advantage specifically said all of these identified patents as well as any continuations, etc.?
The Sherwood to All Advantage agreement?
Right.
So that the Sherwood to All Advantage agreement...
Parties know how to include everything under the sun that might be a patent or patent application possessed by the assigner. And that type of language was not used in the critical assignment we're looking at now.
And isn't it California law that when something is left out of a succeeding document, that it's presumed to be the intent of the parties that they did so?
Well, I'm not sure on that point of California law, but here the Sherwood All Advantage agreement just had the All Advantage side and the Sherwood side. There's nothing about the intent of the transaction back to Mr. Hurley. I mean, so Mr. Hurley wasn't on the Sherwood side of that transaction. He was on the Allset side of the subsequent transaction. Mr. Hurley was at a company earlier called Aveo. There's no intent here to actually exclude that patent, and the district court's result creates an orphan patent in this instance.
Okay, I put you onto this trail, and now I'm going to try to get you off because the clock is running. So why don't you go back to either the 02 patent or the 434 patent on the 101 issue?
Sure, so I'll start with the 02 patent very briefly since it was addressed in the prior argument. So this mobile interface is not, as counsel for Capital One mentioned, an abstract idea that just tacks on an interface. It's not an interface for a mobile device. It's actually an interface that moves. And there are two features that make it inventive. One is that it moves to each of the devices, so the laptop, computer, the PDF. And then while pointers were known in the art, this is an improved use of those pointers. So in the background of the patent, there's a discussion of the start menu and the Windows start menu used pointers, but those were limited to that particular machine. And this new mobile interface that moves around has an improved use of pointers, which is what the PTAB actually concluded in denying CBM review on this patent. And so this doesn't claim just the need or any solution to dynamically accessing information. So it doesn't claim something like web-based access or something like Gmail, where I can log into my Gmail on my PC using Google Chrome, and then I can also log into it on my Mac using Safari. In that instance, there is a mobile interface that actually moves between the two systems. So I think under BASCOM, where an inventive aspect can be found in sort of a novel arrangement, this certainly clears that test. And like BASCOM, we're at the Rule 12 stage, where the only evidence in the record is the patent itself, and the mobile interface is actually the invention. 15 of the claims are to the mobile interface itself. And so if that mobile interface, that is the invention. This isn't anonymous loan shopping on a computer with an interface, delivering content to a specific region and doing it on a screen. The interface itself is
the invention. So the invention is not how the interface retrieves information from wherever it may be located. The invention is the fact that the interface is mobile.
Well, it's two pieces.
And also that the mobile interface uses pointers.
The use of pointers is how it retrieves the information. So it points to a location of the user-specific resources on a server.
And tell me again why that's inventive.
The reason it's inventive is if you look in the background of the patent, the use of pointers in the background are in the Windows start menu that are limited to that specific computer. And the patent office, as I mentioned, in concluding that this invention was a technological innovation, called this use of pointers an inventive use of pointers. And Old Republic, who's one of the defendants in our case, filed that petition. And I think if the patent office concluded that they hadn't met their burden to show that solution was not a technical solution, and the Patent Office also concluded that Old Republic hadn't shown that accessing electronic information across devices was not a technical problem, on a Rule 12 record where 282 applies, we survived that motion. And so, Your Honor, there's already been a finding by the Patent Office that use of pointers, while pointers are conventional, this is an improved use.
Is that IPR, it never became a CBM proceeding. You said
right.
They declared. In connection with which litigation, was there litigation stayed while the IPR proceeding was going on, or what connection was that to which case?
Sure. So in this suit, my client sued Old Republic. They filed a CBM petition, and it got denied. They filed a bunch of IPR petitions. But we never moved in this litigation. They filed, both defendants filed a Rule 12B6 motion at the outset. There was no discovery. They never answered. We never got moving. We had a hearing. The judge granted the motion, and now we're here today. So there was never anything to stay, is the answer, I guess, to that question. Unless the court has any more questions about the 002 patent, I'll move on to the 434 patent. This patent claims a new database architecture like the EnFish case. In particular, computers in the prior art had problems giving back search results, and this patent claims an index metafile tag architecture, including having index components in the records to improve how that database returns searches. In the prior art, there were issues about getting too much information spread out.
What about last week's Intellectual Ventures opinion that came out, where there was the 050 patent, where that claimed invention was about the use of identifiers to search through emails or something like that? So, and then this court held that the concept of using identifiers to search through emails was an ineligible abstract idea. And now here, your claims are the use of XML tags to search through records in a database. What's the difference?
It's not just the use of XML to search through records in a database. And that patent that Your Honor mentioned is directed to just the idea of filtering email, whereas here we're talking about prior art databases had problems with their structures similar to relational databases in EnFish, and that this patent has a particular solution by using an index metafile and tag approach. So it's not just the idea of filtering information, but it's actually organizing that database in a way that enables it to be searched more efficiently. And I don't think that was an issue in the Intellectual Ventures case from last week.
Okay. You're into your rebuttal time, so why don't we reserve that? That's okay.
And thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right. You're splitting your time here. I understand that, and you've notified the court. But at the beginning of when your clock, we're going to run the clock separately. And at the beginning, can you just remind us what issues you're going to deal with so we'll know where to direct our questions?
Yes, and thank you, Your Honor. I will be addressing the ownership issue and the 101 issue for the 434 patent.
Okay.
May it please the court? I'm Greg Lantier on behalf of the Erie appellees in this case. The 2002 All Advantage Assignment specifically lists each patent and application that it transfers. That list does not include the 581 patent application, which was pending at the time of that conveyance. And there are no other words in the document that convey additional patent rights. For example, there's no statement that the inventions described in the transferred patents are also being transferred.
Do you agree with the other side that we have, under California law, we do have to look at some extrinsic evidence in order to satisfy ourselves over whether there's an ambiguity in the contract?
I disagree, Your Honor. California law does treat extrinsic evidence a little bit differently than most states, but the way that California law treats it, and this is described in this court's decision in AMD versus Altera, is if there is a particular term in the contract that is reasonably susceptible to different interpretations, under California law, parole evidence could be admitted not only to determine the meaning of that term, but actually to determine whether that term is ambiguous. And that's the way that California law uses parole evidence in a way that
So I don't understand. Why shouldn't we here rely on parole evidence are you saying we can't determine on to ourselves that this is unambiguous on its face? We have to look at the parole evidence to make a determination about ambiguity? That's what your friend is arguing.
No, Your Honor, that's not what I'm saying.
California law requires some kind of facial ambiguity, does it not?
It does, exactly, Your Honor, and that's precisely what the AMD case says. But I think under California law there's a little bit more liberality if there's a potential facial ambiguity in admitting parole evidence.
But it has to be a potential facial ambiguity.
It has to be reasonably susceptible to the interpretation that's being put forth. And in this case...
Did you cite the AMD case?
Your Honor, I believe we did not cite that case. I'm sorry.
What's the question?
It's an unpublished decision, Your Honor, from 1999, and the citation is 217 F3D 849.
It's unpublished, you said?
It is unpublished, Your Honor. I'm citing it just for the recitation of the California state law.
But that's standard California law.
That is standard California law, Your Honor.
I know, but you cited an F3rd site, so how can it be? It's unpublished?
It's the way that I think West... Your Honor, does assign F3rd sites to cases even when they're just in the table of additional cases.
There must be California state cases on this. Right.
Yes, Your Honor, there are. And as you said, it is standard California law. A California state case on this point would be Wida Associates versus Murner at 42 Cal App 4th, 1702. Also at 50 Cal Reporter 2nd Edition 323, which is a 1996 decision.
423?
I believe I said...
CR 2nd 423? I'm just making...
323, Your
Honor. 323, okay.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, there are no words that are reasonably susceptible to that meaning. And let's make one thing very clear here. This is not a contract reformation case. Intellectual Ventures has never argued for reformation, and that would be the doctrine that would allow the court to rewrite an agreement to include provisions that aren't in the actual text. It requires, however, clear and convincing evidence of each party's intent and clear and convincing evidence that there was an actual mistake. There's no record here on that point. In fact, there's no record at all on All Advantage's intent at the time of the agreement, and we're now 15 years after that agreement was executed.
Why don't you move on to the 434?
Yes, Your Honor. The 434 patent has nothing to do with a technological improvement to databases or to computers.
I guess the other side is saying the 434 is just like EnFish in the sense that the use of XML tags and metafiles necessarily requires the record database to be organized in a particular way, and that by organizing in a particular way, it creates certain efficiencies.
From the perspective of Section 101, Your Honor, this case is the opposite of EnFish. In EnFish, the patent described and the claims were directed to a new type of database, it was called a self-referential database that was different from a relational database. And the patent described that there were advantages in storing data in this new data structure. The invention had nothing to do with how the user was creating the database, how it was entering database records. It had everything to do with how the data structure itself was composed. The 434 patent is exactly the opposite. What the 434 patent describes is a purportedly new methodology for organizing records in a database so that they're indexed and they can be searched in what the 434 patent describes as an advantageous way. What happens is the user is directed at the time that the database records are being entered to have a human being assign what are called tags, so descriptors of that particular record that might be useful later, and write those in some claims in a particular computing language, XML, and in other claims it's not specified. In addition, a user is then to create what they call metafiles. And those metafiles are associations between tags that the user that a searcher might find useful. So, for example, one set of metafiles would group tags that describe related products so that if later somebody searches for one product and you are trying to cross-sell the other product, the database will refer records that that deal with the other product at the same time. So this is completely a business-oriented patent. And the patent, so it's step one of Alice. It is clearly directed to the abstract idea, and the district court's stated abstract idea was exactly correct. It's directed to the creation of a database. Those are claims 1 through 6 and 25. I'm sorry, the creation of an index. Those are claims 1 through 6 and 25 and 26. And then searching that index, and that's the remainder of the claims. The human being is creating the index. The searches are being done, as stated in the patent, using any one of the available conventional databases. And so for that reason, at Alice Step 2, there's a failure as well. The patent expressly states that XML is a standardized computing language that predated the patent. And other than the use of XML, Intellectual Ventures hasn't identified any other supposed technological advance that would be relevant at Alice Step 2.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Vern Winters. I'm here for the Old Republic defendants. I propose to take the Section 101 issues with respect to the 002 patent and the 581 patent. You've just heard argument with respect to the ownership of the 581 patent. If I can, I'd like to start with the patentability of that. This is a patent directed to what Your Honor referred to earlier as the classic gathering, manipulation, and reporting results regarding the manipulation of data. The patent describes systems, methods, and related claims of transmitting across a network a discovery rule. It's just an instruction. It's a sequence of code, according to the patent, to look at data that's been collected by a discovery agent, any collection of data. The discovery rule is then executed upon that collection of data, and according to the patent, that can be any comparison of data whatsoever, not limited in any manner. And then taking that executed discovery rule against the collection of data and just reporting the results back. And that's all this claim does. That is a classic, under this court's post-Alice Section 101 law, classic, not eligible claim. So, for example, if you look at content extraction...
Describe what first-year associates do.
I have a colleague here with me. I perhaps best not respond to that, Your Honor. But, for example, in content extraction, even before the court's recent guideposts that Your Honor referred to, if you look back at content extraction, these claims are like that claim. That claim dealt with digitizing hard copies. So you take a hard copy of a document, you digitize it. You then digitize specific fields within it. You extract some of those fields. And then instead of displaying it to a user, you take those digitized fields and you report it back or store it in memory. That is effectively what these claims do. And the court emphasized in content extraction, that is simply not an eligible idea. And all of these claims are related. The court properly held them all to be ineligible. And unless the court has questions, I propose to move to the 002 Please. Patent. The court has heard about that patent this morning. I'd like to emphasize, if I could, only a limited number of facts. First is, with respect to the mobile interface, the specification, and I'm just going to read this. This is at Appendix 111 at Column 4, Lines 49 through 54. It describes a mobile interface purely by its function. It's basically an agent that allows users to access documents, files, programs, applications, URL bookmarks, IP addresses, telephone numbers, television channels, radio stations, and other menu items from any computer that is connected to a network. That is described functionally. It would be a good idea to be able to access these kinds of items. It doesn't show how to do that. So, for example, one could imagine a claim that addresses the interoperability problem. I'm on a Mac. I want to access files on a different kind of operating system. That's interoperability is a challenge. One could imagine a claim that says, here's how you, with a mobile interface, here's how you solve that problem. Here are the algorithmic steps one needs to take. This claim doesn't do that. It just says, here's a mobile interface. It uses pointers. And there was some discussion earlier in the day about pointers. Pointers, again, are described wholly functionally. If I could invite the court's attention to Appendix 114 at line at column 10, lines 8 to 11. This is from the patent again. A pointer is a link slash shortcut to an item such as a file, URL, IP address, telephone number, television channel, radio station, application, or service. So a pointer is just something that points to a resource, and that's very broadly defined. This is not a case where pointers are limited to a very specific technological context such as one could say there's not a preemptive concern. This is just a pointer goes to data, and that's very broadly defined. They don't claim to invent it. I think we heard in an earlier argument this morning the admission that they haven't claimed to invent it. So again, that the 002 patent is the kind of claim that this court has now repeatedly, starting in the first Capital One IV appeal, but now more recently in cases handed down with as recently as last week, held to be, I think, what the court called a magic interface.
I guess what they're saying is their interface is mobile, right? It's not just located in one place, and the pointers aren't just pointers that are pointing to something inside one computer system. These are pointers that go outside of that single computer system.
Right.
So therefore, these are points of novelty in the claim that produce an inventive concept. What do you have to say about that?
I would invoke the specification, Your Honor. If I could invite the court's attention to this is Appendix 110 in column 1. I'm about lines 35 through 38. A pointer in this context, again, this is the background of the invention. A pointer in this context is a reference to a type of menu item that can be accessible on the computer, PDA, or server. So the pointer, Your Honor, according to the patent, was already performing the function that they now claim is novel, reaching across a network to get to a server. So there's nothing inventive about that. And then with respect to the second part of Your Honor's question, that it's mobile instead of static, that's a function, that's an aspiration, that's a nice to have. I have an interface that is static. It would be a good idea for that to be mobile. Terrific. How does one do that? The claim doesn't say. It just says this would be a good result to reach. This is a good goal to have. But the claim contains nothing about how to get there. And unless the court has questions, I would invite my colleague to be allowed to use the balance of my time.
You've got a minute and a half. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
You have to answer any questions, Your Honor, but otherwise.
Thank you. Mr. Hurt, you've got some time left.
I'd like to start briefly on the contract construction issue under California law. The site for the AMD case that I have, it's 1999 U.S. App Lexus 6272. And that case says the same thing, I believe, as a case we cited in our brief that's a reported California decision. It's Wolf versus Superior Court, 8 California Reporter, 3rd, 649, specifically at 655 and 656. And the law there under a case called PG&E is when the words or a contract are disputed. So when there's a dispute over the words, and the words we dispute, we pointed to the language in and to and the transfer of goodwill, the court then provisions.
When you cite Wolf in your brief, you say if the contract is ambiguous.
Now, the evidence is provisionally, I believe, looked at to determine that, to determine if there is an ambiguity. And if there's a misstatement in the brief on that, I apologize, but the specific language is on 655 through
656. If the plain language of the assignment left room for doubt.
That's correct, because we argued that the plain language for us.
That's ambiguity. That's what we were discussing back and forth. If it doesn't leave room for doubt, it's unambiguous.
That is correct. Our view is under the language alone that Intellectual Ventures is correct, but looking at the extrinsic evidence, which the court must do when there's a dispute under the Wolf case, and I believe the AMD case.
You had a previous document which specifically makes an assignment with specific language, and you leave that language out of a subsequent document. How's that ambiguous?
I believe it's ambiguous because there's no language excluding it, and the relation.
Well, what's the language in the contract, in the assignment, that's your hook, that you believe renders that language reasonably susceptible to two different interpretations?
Sure, Your Honor. So the list, so there's two grants. The list says, here is a list of patents and applications that All Advantage owns. And then there's a transfer of title in and to said patents. It doesn't mention the patents and the applications. Both sides agree that that includes at least the applications in the list. We think it includes, in addition to that, the pure continuation of the 581 because it's effectively the same patent. The second part is there's a grant of goodwill of the business represented by said patents and applications thereof. And in our view, the goodwill of the business has to include... Yes, Your Honor.
It says goodwill of the business symbolized by said patents and applications.
Right.
All right. So when it says said patents and applications, so it's the only logical understanding of that would be the patents that were actually identified in this assignment, right?
Right. So the goodwill of the business represented by said patents and applications, and the goodwill of the business includes the 581 patent application.
That wasn't expressly identified in the contract.
It's not by name and number.
So if we disagree with your understanding of in and to and disagree with your understanding of goodwill, then that's the end of the matter.
Those are the two points in the contract we point to. Under the Wolf case, the court has to provisionally look at the extrinsic evidence to say, well, even under that extrinsic evidence, is the language not reasonably susceptible? And if the court believes that it's not reasonably susceptible to our position, then yes, that's the end.
Okay.
Your time has expired.
Okay. Unless the court has any further questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.